This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. An article in the current edition of Encore magazine is called Building Church 2.0. It looks at how several churches are joining forces to try and draw in new parishioners and keep their current congregations. The article's author, Andrew Domino, joins us next to discuss what he found out about the new Common Ground Church. But first, as Michigan lawmakers look for various ways to boost road funding, the Earned Income Tax Credit has become caught up in the debate. Proposal 1, which was rejected by voters in May, would have increased the Earned Income Tax Credit to help offset the effect of the proposed higher sales tax on low-income residents. Now the plan approved by the State House would eliminate the state's portion of the credit to help come up with the money for fixing roads. The Michigan League for Public Policy has been urging lawmakers not to eliminate the Earned Income Tax Credit as part of any road funding deal. The bills approved by the state Senate leave the credit in place. Gilda Jacobs is the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Gilda Jacobs, thank you for being with us.
Sure. Hi. How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thank you. Explain for our listeners who maybe don't know the minutia here a little bit, have maybe heard about the Earned Income Tax Credit, but don't know the details. How does it work?
Sure. Actually, the Earned Income Tax Credit is a tax credit that goes only to low-income working families. It is a very effective anti-poverty tool. It helps in Michigan to lift thousands of families out of poverty. And it was really created to help offset the fact that low-income working families actually pay a greater percentage of their income in taxes than do people at the higher end of the scale. So it's somewhat of an offset because they have a higher tax burden, if you will.
And there's also, there's a federal component and a state component of the Earned Income Tax Credit,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yes, the federal component was started first. Actually, it was really Republican legislation that was started a number of years ago. And then the state portion of this was created, actually, when I was in the legislature, and it went from 10 to 20% of the federal Earned Income Tax Credit. When the governor was first elected and did some tax changes, the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, was reduced from 20% to 6%, but it stayed on the books, which was really a good thing. So fast forward, the doomed road proposal that went on the ballot, as part of the negotiations in terms of trying to get the votes to actually get that on the ballot, had a restoration, actually had a full restoration of the Earned Income Tax Credit as part of the proposal. So we all know that that proposal failed for a lot of reasons, mostly because it was very complex and people didn't really understand it. But the irony is that when the House came up with a plan, they decided to use the $117 million from the Earned Income Tax Credit to help offset the cost of roads. So, in effect, what they were saying is, you know what, we're going to pave Michigan roads on the backs of the working poor people in our state. And really, that turns out to be a tax increase on people who are working and they're struggling to get by because of low wages. And, you know, at the end of the day, it actually hurts local economies across the state.
How does it hurt local economies?
Well, the money that people get back through the Earned Income Tax Credit is money that goes directly back into those communities. So people use that money for a car repair. They may use it to catch up on their rent. They may use it to catch up on a utility bill, maybe buy shoes for their kids or at the corner grocery store. It's not money that they're using to go to a vacation, you know, in the Bahamas. I mean, it's money that is very real to them and where the, you know, in the big picture, in terms of what it's going to cost to pave the roads, that $117 million is a drop in the bucket. But for folks who are getting back a couple of $100 from the state EITC, that can, you know, sometimes make a huge difference in a family, you know, in terms of keeping, you know, the water running in their place as well.
Well, Representative Jeff Farrington, who's the chairman of the House Roads and Economic Development Committee, has argued for eliminating the state's portion of the EITC. And one of the things he says is that the average amount received by those in the state claiming the credit comes to only $2.70 a week. Is that figure accurate? And would you say that it's still important at $2.70 a week that the family gets it?
Well, depending on the family size, you know, and what they're earning, it can be $270 a week or more. But for somebody who is low income, so that's $270 a week times four, so that's $10. That's $10 a month. You know, the cost of formula, the cost of diapers, the cost of milk are very, very high. And, you know, even if it's $10 a month or $15 a month or $20 a month, for somebody who is struggling every day to make ends meet, that actually helps them meet their bills. So that $270 may not mean a lot to a representative or a senator, but it sure does mean a lot to the struggling working families that are in their districts. So I would not poo-poo $270 a week at all.
Representative Farrington has also said that there was a federal audit that found the program is burdened with fraud. Is there evidence of widespread fraud in the earned income tax credit?
This IRS studies show that the main source of overpayments to individuals was really through unintentional errors, not fraud. And the errors really show that this is a very, very complex program. For example, families that sometimes get this credit have very complex family arrangements. So there could be multi-generational families or separated parents. The interesting thing is that a very big source of the errors are really because the tax preparers are unregulated. So most of the errors were really made by people who were preparing the taxes, and they really weren't trained very well. So Treasury is working on trying to address this problem. Listen, we do not believe that fraud and abuse are things that we want to perpetuate. We believe that there need to be very reasonable and responsible measures to reduce errors, but we also don't want to compromise or undermine a program or reduce benefits to people who do qualify. So we have to, you know, take very great care and design a program that has integrity measures. So we really don't believe that that fraud and abuse is a huge problem. And again, the IRS showed that these mostly were unintentional errors.
The proponents of eliminating the state's portion of the credit will say that most of the benefit people are getting is coming from the federal portion of this. And we did note earlier there is a federal component. How much difference does that state part make, even reduced as it has been under the original proposal when Governor Snyder came in? How much of a gap is that still filling when the state has its portion of the earned income tax credit available to people?
You know, for people that are living on the edge, losing out on a couple hundred dollars a year can mean the difference between having a set of tires on your car to get to work or not. And a lot of other states right now, or, you know, around the country, are actually increasing the earned income tax credit. They're not eliminating it. So why Michigan would want to try to eliminate this when it is it's actually a very proven, useful tool in helping people get by, makes me kind of scratch my head. You know, we know it helps to reduce poverty. We know it builds economic security. And this is something that I think everybody on both sides of the aisle can agree upon.
You commissioned a poll of state residents to gauge what their thoughts are. What did that show?
Yeah, I mean, and that is really interesting. The recent polls show that two-thirds of people in Michigan support the Michigan Earned Income Tax Credit, and they're opposed to plans to eliminate it to fund roads. Voters really favor paying for road improvements with a gas tax increase over cutting the earned income tax by a 55% to 7% margin. And then by a margin of 74% to 17%, voters said that the EITC is an important benefit for working families who are near the poverty line. And 65% said that the earned income tax credit makes Michigan tax system more fair. So the people in Michigan agree that it's an important credit. They believe it's important to lifting families out of poverty. And, you know, we hope that the Michigan legislature will understand that the people in their districts believe this and want them to vote differently than it appears to be going down this track right now.
Do you think that part of the problem here, though, is that Proposal 1 did not get wide support, and perhaps that there are lawmakers who have read that as the earned income tax credit wasn't that big a deal to the voters of Michigan?
No. I mean, maybe that's how they're trying to frame this. But that is really not what happened. When, you know, when people were polled about why they voted against their proposal, it was not that the earned income tax credit was not a big deal. They voted against it because they felt the legislature didn't do their job. They felt that the legislature, you know, went home for the summer. They felt that the legislature punted. And it was also a very, very complex ballot proposal. And, you know, we know that when things are complex, people tend to vote no. So, you know, for those proponents of trying to get rid of it, to try to frame this as people didn't care really about the earned income tax credit, I think is really a very false assumption.
Now, you served as a state lawmaker for many years before going to the Michigan League for Public Policy, so you obviously have some institutional knowledge. We should also point out that the cast of characters has changed a bit since you left, especially now in Michigan with term limits. The turnover is pretty rapid. But what is your sense of, with the House having passed one bill and the Senate having passed a different plan, what is going to tip the balance here one way or another in terms of what ends up going to the governor, if anything ultimately does?
All right, well, I think this is what disturbs me and concerns me the most. So there is going to be an effort, probably with both chambers, to raise as little in taxes as they possibly can and try to take an already pinched and restricted general fund budget and try to squeeze out of that budget money to go into roads. Well, if you put money from an already dwindling source, which we have right now, and put that into roads, that means we have to take money out of other things. So where are we going to take that money out of? Well, if you take a look at what most of the money that we spend in Michigan, it's on health care, it's on schools, it's on corrections. So what areas do we want to further cut? We need our state to be a very competitive state. You know, we hear that we want to attract talent, we want to keep talent here, but as we keep cutting further to the bone till we get to the marrow, it's not going to be a whole lot in our state that is going to be attractive for people to want to come here or stay here. So I think we hope the legislature isn't penny wise and pound foolish in not looking at new revenue sources in order to keep Michigan an attractive state. And one of the ways that we're going to do that is by having good, safe roads, but not at the expense of low-income people and kids.
So if you're going to get new revenue and do it in a way that doesn't unfairly impact the people at the lowest rungs of the economic ladder, where should state lawmakers be looking?
Well, I think they should be looking at figuring out a fairer system of taxation than we have right now. And you have to make some hard decisions when you're in the legislature that you are voted in to do. And sometimes it means increasing the pot. You've got to grow the pot in order to take care of all of the needs of the state. It doesn't mean shrinking the pot.
You mentioned earlier that the poll numbers show that there is support for the earned income tax credit. You're also urging people to contact their lawmakers and urge them not to cut it, not to reduce it anymore in order to pay for road repairs. Do you sense that this issue has that sort of salience, if you will, for the population, that they're going to be motivated to try and encourage their lawmakers to do something else?
Well, it doesn't have to be just that population that benefits from the earned income tax credit that will be calling their lawmakers. We're hoping that all people in the state will understand and then understand how important this issue is to the state. And everybody should be making calls to their legislators to talk about, you know, how you create a road funding proposal does not negatively impact certain sectors of society. So we're not just asking low-income people to call. We're asking people who understand the moral end of what we're actually trying to talk about, which is you don't create budgets that are balanced on the backs of low-income people. That's not a great way to run a government.
Gilda Jacobs, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Gilda Jacobs is the president of the Michigan League for Public Policy. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. A new collaboration of churches in the Kalamazoo area is looking to stop a decline in church membership and religious affiliation. In a story called Building Church 2.0 for the current edition of Encore magazine, Andrew Domino tells us how these churches are working together and trying a new approach. Andrew Domino, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So who are these churches that are working together?
There's several churches locally that are part of two different denominations, the Reformed Church of America and the Christian Reformed Church. Both are based in the West Michigan area, one in Grand Rapids and one in Holland. And they're looking to build up their congregation, build up their growth together by forming a new kind of a church.
And there's some historic significance to these two churches working together, right?
Right. They were part of the same denomination in the 1800s, and they split apart dogma grounds. Some of their belief systems were a little bit different. And then they decided to keep going in that way, but they're close enough that they feel they can come back together.
So how concerned are these church leaders that you talk to about the studies that show that church attendance has been in decline, that more people are identifying as agnostic or maybe even atheist, and that there's a significant number of people who say they're really not part of organized religion anymore?
For them, the issue at the church level, building this new church, their concern was mainly getting themselves off the ground, and they were feeling that God would bring people into the church to help build it up. They were really focused on the technical part of it. But there was an admission that the old way of doing church with the traditional prayers and hymns and things like that is not really welcoming to people in this day and age.
So if someone's going to go and start a church, how big a task are they taking on?
Well, it really is like starting a new business. You need to do some market research. You need to figure out who you've got in your area and what kind of things they want to see, and then build it up from there. You need to find out what you need to bring to them to make it interesting for them.
And this is a church which is called Common Ground. They're not really off the ground yet, are they?
They're just getting started. They are eyeing September of this year to make it their first official opening service, I guess you'd say.
You mentioned before the idea of trying to create a more welcoming atmosphere. And this is very interesting from your story that the pastor, Chet Carlson, doesn't wear a robe. There's no heavy cross in sight. Churchgoers are encouraged to read along in the Bible. And PowerPoint presentations illustrate the ideas in Carlson's sermons. Do they think this is making it something that people can relate to a little bit better, or are they perhaps acknowledging the fact that our attention spans are shorter than they were 30 years ago?
I think it's a little bit of both. They're really encouraging people to feel casual, feel like you're hanging out at a party or just with some friends, as opposed to, oh, I have to go to church. This is the Sunday morning task that I have to do for myself.
Are they also, in effect, trying to modernize the church service with some of the music selections and things like that?
Definitely. The church music at that service at Common Ground is definitely more the Christian pop songs as opposed to the traditional hymns. There's no these and thous or anything like that.
One of the things you say is that it looks like a business meeting, complete with people checking their phones, except they're looking up Bible verses and not texting. Now, I just have to ask, are they checking to make sure that people are looking up Bible verses and not texting or looking at Facebook or things like that?
They'll take the word for them, take it on faith, as you might say. There's definitely a movement to do the app. I saw people, instead of opening a Bible book and flipping the pages to find the verse that the pastor was talking about, going on their app, spinning through until they found the verse. Same end result, but a different way of doing it.
Would the pastor, Chet Carlson, say that despite the change in presentation, that the message is still very much the same as it was in a traditional church setting? Or does he think that there is some change in what the church is actually telling people?
They're definitely hewing close to the Bible, to be sure, but he definitely wanted to, in his sermons, were less about relating specific Bible stories and more about how do today's issues affect the members of the church, the congregants. You know, how does their belief affect their regular lives?
The services are only 20 minutes long. Why are they so short?
Because they want people to discuss. There's a big movement in the Common Ground Church to break away from the service itself and go back into smaller discussion groups and talk about what you learned during that sermon, or just introduce yourself. If you're a first-time visitor to the church, they just want you to introduce yourself and feel comfortable going there so that you'll want to come back and get to know the people that are attending the church.
So the 20-minute service is more or less just kind of the start. There's going to be more to it than that.
Really, there really is. It starts out with the sermon and some music, and Pastor Carlson introduces the whole concept. And then after that, you get into whatever section of the church you want to explore more. You want to talk about your faith more. You want to get to know the people there more. You want to just reflect on your own life over the past week. Any of those things are an avenue you can follow after the service itself.
So the discussion group is really an integral part of what you're doing here. This is an integral part of the church experience if you're going to Common Ground.
I would say Common Ground's goal is to have the discussion groups after the service the primary focus. The sermon and the music is a good element that you probably expect from a church service, but the discussions are where the heart of it is.
Is this, again, an effort to try and make church more accessible to people? If they feel that there's a real discussion going on, a give and take, a back and forth, then they're going to feel more a part of the church than they might if they are just sitting through a sermon and some songs and some readings on a Sunday.
Several people I talked to for the story said that they wanted people to spend more time on what mattered to them instead of just going to the church because they felt like it was the thing they needed to do to as part of their week's schedule or something along those lines. They wanted to really make it interesting to them, make it worth their time instead of just a thing that you do as part of your daily life or your weekly life.
And Common Ground is trying to encourage people to try their church. Is there any competition that's going on where they might be taking parishioners away from another church to come and attend at Common Ground?
You know, I would have thought that because they are drawing from five other churches in the area to form Common Ground, but the people who are involved in the startup of Common Ground say that they felt this was their mission from God in a way. They were driven to do this to help this new church start up and this new way of doing things. And there's certainly an invitation to go back and forth between your old church and Common Ground if you'd like, either way. They don't see it as competition at all. They see it just as a new opportunity for you to show your faith.
Sounds like what I've heard people say about modern entrepreneurism, that it's more a collaboration than a competition, where the ultimate goal is to bring in more people, in the case of a business, customers, but in this case, more church parishioners who therefore would be populating pews perhaps at several churches.
They want everybody to get to know God.
You did talk to some people who have tried Common Ground. What did they say about Common Ground? Why did they try it, and what do they like about it?
They liked very much, the mention was that we liked the casualness. There was no, you didn't have to dress up. You didn't have to go through the Bible and know all of the stories or anything along those lines. The songs were very easy to listen to, just like listening to anything else on the radio. And they liked that ease of getting to know things. And they felt very comfortable with the pastor as well. He wasn't shouting at them about some social issue or anything like that. He was just inviting them to hear the word of God.
And the casual tone sort of starts with the pastor.
Very much so.
So do the organizers of Common Ground see themselves as being able to truly hit the ground running in September, which is their goal? Where do things stand right now? Where do they hope to be in the fall?
They're still looking for a permanent home. I know they're at the campus at Western Michigan University for the time being, and they're still shopping around a location. But other than that, I think they're ready to go. They have a lot of resources donated to them from some of the churches that are sponsoring them, some of the mechanisms for doing the PowerPoint presentations and the music and the like. So really, they're just looking for a permanent home. But they have a number of people attending, and they're trying to get the word out. And hopefully, by the fall, they'll even be bigger than they are right now.
You know, we've talked about this church in sort of a business sense of trying to bring in new parishioners, or at least stop people from not going to church, to sort of stop that exodus, I think is the phrase you use in your story, which of course is also a biblical term. But I'm wondering if there is sort of a a market that they are looking at, that they think, you know, these are people we could reach. There's a certain type of person who might not be affiliated with a church right now, but would like our church. Do they look at it that way?
Well, of course, they're saying that everybody's a potential person to join the church. And I think in a lot of cases, they're viewing it as a lot of people are interested in going to church. They believe in God, for example, but they used to go to church when they were a kid, or they go maybe just at Easter and Christmas and just haven't gotten in the habit because they felt intimidated or they felt that they were just too busy. But if it's a comfortable church like Common Ground is going for, with a short service and just opportunity just to talk with people and just meet people like you would at a business networking event, then it may be a little bit easier, more palatable to join them.
Are they then, from what it sounds like you're saying, they're staying away from like social issues and maybe talking more about people's day-to-day lives as it relates to faith rather than issues like same-sex marriage or something like that?
Yeah, I don't think they want to scare anyone off at this point. And I don't think that's really the kind of the approach that these denominations of the church are really interested in touching on. They didn't appear opposed to talking about those sorts of things if it came up in the course of the conversation. But right at this point, they just want to get going and they want everybody to feel comfortable.
Overall, what impression did you have of this group of churches, what they're trying to do? What impressions, I guess, were you left with in terms of how successful they can be and maybe what some of the obstacles might be in the way of them reaching those goals?
I think that part of their issue might be getting more people in the door. I'm not sure you can't really do traditional marketing. I suppose you could. You could put ads in the newspaper or the magazine or something like that.
But resources are limited and they're focusing
right.
on some other things right now.
Yeah, it's like any other business, startup business. You need money, you need a way to get the word out. And in this case, they're not selling a product, they're selling God in a way. So it's something that is an uphill battle in a couple different ways. Not only are you trying to get the word out that you exist, but also that you're talking about something that may or may not matter to people that they're speaking with.
When they're talking to you about their plans, how optimistic do they sound?
They're putting a lot of faith in God, well, to put it simply. They want to get themselves up and running as a business, more or less, and then when people come in the door, that's through the providence of God.
Andrew Domino, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can read Andrew Domino's story, Building Church 2.0, in the current issue of Encore magazine. There's also a link to the story on our website at wmuk.org. West Southwest airs Mondays and Thursdays. It can be heard at 9:30 in the morning and again in the afternoon at 3:30. Links with more information, longer versions of interviews, and past programs can be found at wmuk.org. If you have a comment or suggestion, find us on Facebook or on Twitter at WMUK1021. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.